This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina's House Bill 2 stirred up conversations around the country about the lives of transgender Americans. It has also illuminated many misconceptions about what gender identity is and how it's formed. Groups of medical professionals around the state have stood up in opposition to HB 2, arguing that for the vast majority of individuals, gender identity is not a choice. They've written letters to the editor and directly to Governor Pat McCrory about the genetic and biological causes of gender differences and many individuals for whom gender assignment at birth is not possible. One of these physicians joins me in the studio today. Dr. Dina Adkins is a pediatric endocrinologist and the director of the Duke Center for Child and Adolescent Gender Care. Dr. Adkins, welcome to the State. Thanks. Good to have you here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about the Duke Center for Child and Adolescent Care. It opened just last year. What kind of work do you do?
Yes, we started last July because we wanted to have a team approach to kids with gender differences. We see a broad group of kids, both the children that are born with gender that aren't completely obvious at birth, as well as kids who are transgender. And we have a really good team, including psychiatry, psychology, urology, endocrine, OBGYN, to really kind of support families and help them through this really tough time.
Tell us how you got into this work.
I was just doing general endocrine and diabetes a number of years ago, and another physician from New York called up and said, there's a patient in your area who needs some care, and they're transgender, and I would really like you to help me take care of them. I said, sure, absolutely, happy to help, but I don't really know how to do it. I wasn't trained for that. And so he sent me all of his papers, and I dug in and learned a lot and realized it was very much like what I already do with my other endocrine patients and helping them either get through puberty at the right time or the right puberty or puberty at all.
So tell us more about that and what you do and why what you just said, helping them get through at the right time, is critical to this conversation.
Well, when you are transgender or your gender identity doesn't match your assigned sex at birth, it takes a while for people to really work through and think about sometimes what they want to do about that. People transition socially at different ages. People transition medically, which means usually hormones, at a different time. And then surgically, often much later. And so we will allow them to have space and time by stopping their puberty when it starts. And then when it's time and they're older and they're better prepared and they really know what they want, that their gender identity really is absolutely not matching their natal sex or their assigned sex at birth, then we help them go through that puberty, which matches their gender identity.
All right. And help me understand what you just said. When they decide, when they find out what they want, by want, do you mean that this is an arbitrary decision? It could go either way? Or is there something dictating to them who they are in terms of their sex and gender?
Sure. And gender identity is formed and realized by kids, usually beginning at a very young age, 2 to 5 years old. And most parents will know this because they'll know that their child starts talking about boys and girls. And then there are some kids who realize that age, that they are not a boy and they're not a girl, even though their parents have been saying that to them and the culture around them has been addressing them that way. And they'll speak up at this point and say, no, you're wrong. And that's their core gender identity in their brain saying that I don't care what the body looks like, this is not right for me. And at that point, there's further development later on when puberty comes into play that also can trigger some discomfort or dysphoria around their gender. And that dysphoria is when you have to sort of think about intervening. And it's not a choice. It it's around the anxiety and stress that's caused with the kids. And what we're trying to do is treat that stress and anxiety and eliminate the dysphoria around that incongruence between their gender identity.
What dysphoria is?
Dysphoria is feeling that something is very wrong with you and whatever that aspect is. It could be around a particular part of your body. It could be around your voice. But for people who have gender dysphoria, it's around their gender not matching their assigned sex at birth.
All right. And so talk about the difficulty then of assigning sex at birth. It sounds like this is not a quite well-developed science.
It's a really tough thing for a lot of people. Most people think it's fairly easy. The OBGYN says, hey, you're a boy or you're a girl. But it's not that clear for a lot of people. And we care for, as endocrinologists, a whole broad spectrum of people who, when you take a look at them at birth, their gender isn't obvious. It doesn't match what we typically see for a boy or a girl. And at that point, we have to gotta go in and take a look at what helps you develop your gender. And that starts with the chromosomes that you have. And then those chromosomes, of course, give instructions and tell your body how to make your body. And it tells your body which ovaries or testes or that sort of thing. And then it tells your body what outer parts to make. And a lot of different steps are required in that process, and there are a lot of different steps where that can go wrong. Differently even. I wouldn't necessarily say wrong, but go differently than the standard development.
So this is why you use a hormone treatment when you find this is happening, and again, this psychological difficulty that an individual is having between their God-given gender and the way they may have appeared at birth. Mm-hmm. Then these two things are at odds. By delaying the onset of puberty, it allows people to make the psychological adjustment as they mature into what is their God-given gender.
Absolutely. Because it's a difficult decision to make at 9 or 10. It's difficult to make at 16 or 17, too, but it becomes much more a better place to do that when you're more knowledgeable.
You've said that patients that you see fall into two broad categories. Can you tell us more about that?
So those are those children that I was first talking about, is the group who are born where their sex is or gender isn't obvious at birth. And we help them figure out what gender we're going to assign them based on all those things I mentioned before, and then allow them to grow older and to the point where they can tell us what their gender identity is. And once they tell us what their gender identity is, we help them match that gender identity and their actual puberty and the rest of their gender.
All right. So you've been part of a group at Duke, the Duke Medical Faculty, and a group of pediatric endocrinologists that have spoken out against House Bill 2.
Yes.
Tell us about your objections to HB 2.
Well, as you can imagine, it's very stressful to have your gender identity not match what you look like on the outside. And there's a lot of challenges for parents and kids just dealing with that, both for transgender individuals and for these other children who, you know, a lot of people don't really understand because it is so complicated. And what I've seen happen with HB2 is that this puts a lot more stress on these individuals because they can't even make a decision about going to the restroom. They can't go alone. They generally have to go with someone else. They're seeing a lot more harassment in the restrooms, whereas before everyone was going to the bathroom and no one had any idea what was going on. And it really causes a stigma for my patients that is unacceptable and very harmful to them. And that stigma is really what we try to help alleviate in our practice. And that stigma is what causes them to do self-harm. And their biggest risk for loss of life is self-harm and suicide. Up to 40% of them attempt suicide at some point. And that was really part of what drove me towards helping these wonderful individuals, because that is just a huge risk. And I couldn't bear to see them face that if there was something I could do to help them. And now I'm trying to help them again.
Right. The interesting thing is there's no enforcement mechanism in HB2, so mm-hmm. it can't make restrooms safer, as its proponents have said. It can't, because there are no enforcements. And, of course, it's still illegal to do any kind of molestation or anything that would have happened. Nothing changes there.
Yes.
But what about, you've given us a lot of information that, frankly, I didn't know before I got ready for this segment. Did anybody in the legislature talk to you in the hour that they gave for discussion about this bill?
Not a one.
So really, all the information that you've had, biological information that puts, frankly, puts in dispute much of what they claimed, they didn't have access to. They didn't ask you about any of that.
As far as I know, they did not ask me.
Well, Dr. Atkins, it was a pleasure to talk with you, and I thank you for the elucidation. I feel more educated today, and I appreciate you being on the program.
Happy to be here. I hope I can help.
Dr. Dina Atkins is director of the Duke Center for Child and Adolescent Gender Care, and you can find out more about her and the center at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk with a Jewish and a Christian author about religion's role in conservation and the environment. Stay tuned.